Welcome to the LinkedIn Lady Show with Carol McManus. Social media is a great tool and a great way to do business in today's social and mobile-driven world. And the LinkedIn Lady Show with Carol McManus is designed to inform, inspire, and educate businesses, entrepreneurs, and individuals on the effective use of social media for growing their personal business. Coming up on today's show, you'll learn more about social media, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and of course, LinkedIn. Here we go with the LinkedIn Lady Show. Now, here's your host, Carol McManus.
And hello, everyone, and welcome to the LinkedIn Lady Show. This is the voice of Carol McManus, your host, and of course, known as America's LinkedIn Lady. So happy you are with us today. And boy, is it an interesting day, an interesting week, an interesting time in the world of social media, digital tools, and of course, that scary little thing called hacking. And ironically, the guest that I had scheduled for today is an expert in this space. You're going to learn a lot about him. We're going to talk about his most recent books and a whole lot of things, but we're probably going to start off talking about what's in the news. But let me give Frederick the formal introduction here. Frederick Lane is an author, an attorney, an expert witness, and a professional speaker on legal and cultural implications of emerging technology, with a particular focus on law, privacy, cyber safety, and ethics. He graduated from Amherst College and Boston College Law School and clerked for 2 years for the Honorable Frank H. Friedman, Chief Judge of the U.S. District Court in Massachusetts. After practicing law for 5 years and writing his first book, Vermont Jury Instructions, Civil and Criminal, he launched a computer consulting business that in turn led to his current work, again, as an author, lecturer, and computer forensics expert. And there's a whole lot more to say. I want to highlight, three books that we're going to touch on today. The older of them, that it's been out for a number of years, called The Naked Employee, is just a fascinating read. And he'll tell us a little bit about that. That actually was written before the social media explosion. And I mentioned to Frederick earlier that it's amazing to me how relevant it still is, even more relevant. And then the two that we're going to focus on for today's interview are Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads and Cyber Traps for Educators. And then he has a new one out that he's going to be talking about. But let's jump right into it so I don't waste valuable time. Frederick, welcome to the LinkedIn Lady Show.
It's a pleasure, Carol. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, listen, I am thrilled and honored. And boy, the timing of this interview could not be probably better timed or worse timed. I'm not sure which. But the only thing I've been hearing on the news, obviously, for the past, it started, I guess, late last week, is this global hack attack and the ransomware. We hear about hacks, we hear about ransomware, but this one is of a magnitude that I personally have never seen. I don't think any of us have, nor had I ever imagined it. So you're the expert here. Bring us up to date. What's going on?
Well, it's actually an incredibly important topic. The basic structure of this attack, as people are probably aware, is that it is a form of malware that uses a variety of different techniques, basically known as phishing, to get onto an individual's computer. And this was specifically aimed at corporate computer systems. One of the implications of this, or one of the facts around this case that is so disturbing, is that it appears to have been built out of the WikiLeaks hack of NSA documents. Basically, the argument is, or the appearance is, that there was information contained in those document dumps that enabled hackers this assault on Microsoft server software. And one of the things that is particularly disturbing and scary about this, Carol, is that from a technical perspective, this was not a very sophisticated piece of software. If it had been better written, it actually would have been much more destructive than it actually was. But the upshot of it basically was that any computer on which this virus propagated was locked down in terms of access to data. And the only way to unlock the data is to pay a Bitcoin ransom. Bitcoins, of course, are these electronic generated financial substitute that are extremely popular among people who operate in the subterranean world of the internet, because Bitcoins cannot be traced the way other kinds of financial instruments can be. So the upshot is you had a release of confidential information being used by hackers outside of, you know, legal structures to attack a known vulnerability in probably the world's most popular software and holding vast amounts of data for ransom. It's a great plot for a movie, but in reality, it's actually a really terrifying assault on the instruments and the tools that we use every day to make modern life work.
Yeah, and boy, was it a wake-up call once again on how dependent we are on computers and yet how vulnerable we really are. I mean, when you hear on the news, I guess I heard a lot of it out of the UK, where entire hospitals mm-hmm. were shut down. They had to cancel surgeries. This is pretty serious stuff. You know, it's bad enough when a company loses its data temporarily and pays a ransom and gets it back. That's bad enough. But when people's lives are at risk, it does take on, and the epic proportions of this, of how many countries that it impacted. It was really quite mind-blowing with the expectation that it might get worse before it gets better. Because I guess I heard one young man being interviewed, I think he was on the Today Show this morning, he'd been interviewed, that and he has a company somewhere and had found the, what do they call it, the kill switch, but that the new version that they came out with doesn't have the kill switch, meaning that you can't stop it.
Right. So, and what that young man had done, which was absolutely brilliant, was he had gone through the code for the initial release of this ransomware and discovered that as part of the function of the ransomware, the software was invoking a particular web address. And he somehow, I can't believe that they were actually this sloppy, but he somehow was able to either register the domain name that was targeted by the software or somehow gain control of it. And when he did that, that version of the software would no longer work. But then, of course, all you had to do was to release a version of the software that didn't do that. And then that particular backdoor goes away. Look, the much broader issue on all of this, Carol, is that, you know, there needs to be a much more comprehensive approach to security. We need to rethink the way that these things happen, because what really leads to the success of this kind of attack is that the server software has to be updated by every individual consumer of that software. And that invariably, given human nature, is an incomplete process. And so when vulnerabilities are inevitably discovered, the responsibility falls on the businesses to fix it. And if they don't, then they make themselves and everybody who interacts with them vulnerable. One of the things, you know, by way of example, just to give your listeners a counterexample, is that I have one of the Amazon Echoes that I love using. It's actually a really cool tool. But the nice thing about that as a device with which I interact is that the software updates are all automatically done from the cloud by Amazon. I don't actually have mm-hmm. to do anything to have the software up to the latest version. And eventually, I guess what I think will end up having to happen is that we will need to move to that kind of model universally, so that, you know, when you purchase a piece of software, what you're effectively doing is allowing automatic updates to ensure that these vulnerabilities don't persist.
And you're not waiting for somebody to, you know, to update it in your IT department who happens to be on vacation this week, or it went into somebody else's inbox and they're thinking, oh, we'll get around to it. You know, it's another update. We're going to wait and see if Microsoft, you know, how many bugs it has before we update it, which is a typical thing that I hear.
The other thing real quickly is that, you know, we have created an incredibly complicated infrastructure on which we are dependent, and it only takes a hacker one vulnerability to create chaos, whereas the people who use and rely on this technology basically have to be perfect all the time. And so by the very nature of humans, we're vulnerable.
Boy, it's unbelievable. So any other bits of advice before we move off of this topic of what people should do right now? Like, well, let me ask you this. Are personal computers and small business computer systems, small networks,
not
are
in
they
this
vulnerable?
Particular attack from what I've seen, but this should be a warning to anybody who uses a computer, because there are absolutely consumer-aimed versions of ransomware. So the three rules very quickly are: absolutely, number one, back up everything. Number two, have really good antivirus and anti-malware installed on your computer. And then three, do whatever updates, you know, make sure you've got a program that helps you keep track of updates. And even better yet, one that does them automatically so that your computer is as protected as possible. But the single best thing is make sure you have a current backup. I actually recommend strongly for my friends and family that they use cloud storage. Amazon, you can use Google Drive, you can use Dropbox, any number of different things. But if you do your stuff in the cloud, your critical data, then on the off chance that something gets through your protection, you don't actually have to pay someone to get your data back because it's protected in the cloud.
Good point. And you know, it's so funny because we've talked about computer backups for now decades since we've been using computers in the workforce. And I'm stunned and amazed at how many people still don't take that message seriously or don't back up frequently. They might back up once a week, once a month. You know, it's like, no. Just put it on autopilot, do it at 2 o'clock in the morning every night and be done. Then at worst case scenario, you know, if something happens, you might lose a day's worth of data.
Exactly,
you know,
right. And it's just, it makes it easier to sleep at night, honestly. We have enough else to worry about.
It really is. Well, we'll have to have another. I don't want to go into this today, but I just learned recently about block and chain and this new model that is coming out as the quote unquote so-called replacement for the internet or a different model than the internet. And I'm fascinated by what that can and will not, what it can do and the transparency that supposedly will stop hacking. But anyway, we'll save that for another day. I want to talk about you. So before we go into the books, tell me how you got into this crazy space and, you know, just give me, add to the bio, I guess.
Well, that's great, Carol. It's been an interesting journey. You know, the old stock investing tip, the drunkard's journey. My mm-hmm. career has had a little bit of that going on. Basically, the upshot of it is that I clerked, as you said, for a couple of years. And then I was in private practice in Vermont for about 4.5 years and didn't really have a good fit with the kinds of law that I was doing and had always been interested in technology. So after practicing for a while, I began doing some computer consulting for firms in Vermont. And that was at about the same time that the Congress was considering the Communications Decency Act, in which Congress basically was responding to the rise of the online adult industry and to put it mildly, freaking out about it. So they passed this law, which Bill Clinton signed in 1996, called the Communications Decency Act. And what was interesting about that was that they were trying to make it a felony to distribute indecency across the internet and obscenity. But the fact that they included indecency caught my eye because that's not the constitutional standard. So I began researching that. There were a lot of fascinating social and economic issues associated with that whole phenomenon. And eventually that led to the publication of my first book, Obscene Profits, which came out in 2000. And it was really an attempt to understand not only how the adult industry was so successful online, but how it was changing our attitudes towards the pornography industry in general. And that's another whole show all by itself, because that's been a significant and ongoing social phenomenon. Then the naked employee followed right after that because a lot of employees were looking at adult websites in their workplace. This in turn, not a good thing to do. But at the time, you may remember this, that really only businesses had faster connections. So employees, I remember this anecdote when I was researching these books, that the webmasters for the adult industry could literally watch offices opening across the country as each time zone went to work, because people would get into work. And one of the first things that some people would do is flip on their computer and start surfing the adult web. Just amazing stuff. Anyway, I wrote The Naked Employee. Then I wrote a book about the 2004 Super Bowl halftime show. Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake, sort of continuing mm-hmm. the theme of, mm-hmm. of decency and cultural change. Did a book on the court and the cross and then privacy. And at the same time, I was on the Burlington School Board and I became very interested in the use of technology by kids. And that led to the publication of Cyber Traps for the Young in 2011. And I've stayed with that theme. That was actually the first of what are three Cyber Traps books. And then you read the two most recent.
Mm-hmm.
One is Cyber Traps for Educators. And then the last one, the one that came out in October, is Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads. And I think that the concept of cyber traps is worth explaining. Basically, I use that term to refer to basically any unintended consequence that arises from the use or misuse of digital devices. So a good example, for instance, which I talked about in Cyber Traps for the Young, is the idea of children sexting. When Steve Jobs released the iPhone in 2007, nobody gave much thought to the possibility that kids would start taking nude photos of themselves. But they very quickly began to do that. And that has raised significant issues with respect to application, for instance, of child pornography laws. What do we do with the fact that the laws that were designed to protect kids are now actually being used to prosecute them for, you know, basically playing doctor with each other, which is basically what they're doing? I mean, it goes a little bit beyond that, certainly when you're talking about kids in middle school and high school where, you know, hormones are taking over and it's part of their sexual exploration. But it does raise really challenging issues. And that was absolutely an unintended consequence. You know, obviously cyberbullying, we talk about voyeurism, we talk about hacking. There's a lot of different things that come out of that.
Well, and the thing that struck me as I have, you know, matured myself in this space and certainly in reading your books, because I was sort of pleased to see that what I am thinking and what I have been advocating with my business clients really is right in line with the types of things that you're talking to parents about and you're talking to educators about. And if, you know, if I could summarize it in one sentence, which you really can't, but the simple sentence is, well, is think before right. you post. I mean, hello, because there are no takeaways. There is no permanent delete button. It's there forever. It's there for a lifetime. And boy, are there traps, as you say. I love cyber traps because it just says it all. So let's jump into the cyber traps for educators. And for my business listeners, we're going to be talking about this in the context of the education system. But I have to tell you, as every word that I read in that book, I could apply it and cross over into things that I have seen or I'm working with in the business workforce. So this is because most of my listeners, of course, are small and medium-sized businesses, marketers, you know, educators, speakers, authors, and a lot of entrepreneurs who are all dealing with these things. And I think many are still trying to find their way and find their voice. And while it's great that the internet gives us that opportunity for, call it full expression, there are some consequences. So let me start off with something that came up fairly early in the book that really hit me. And then I'll let you take it from there. You said, don't post anything. This is for teachers. This was a message for teachers and educators. Don't post anything that you wouldn't say or show at a PTA meeting. And I got to tell you, I just loved that because to me, again, it sort of says it all. If you wouldn't put it out there at a PTA meeting, why on earth are you putting it online? So
that sounds
go
great,
ahead
girl.
And run from
well,
there.
Look, I've been researching educators and their use of digital technology now for the better part of 6 or 7 years, obviously starting with Cyber Traps for the Young. And the thing that persistently strikes me is the tendency of educators, and to be fair, it's not just them. It's people in every walk of life, every business, every profession, to use social media either as a personal diary or as, you know, do-it-yourself therapy, as far as I can tell. And so what ends up happening is that social media is treated as a safe space to unload whatever your innermost thoughts are. And my line to educators, because I travel all over the country talking to school districts, to individual schools, private schools, all the rest of that. You know, my line to all of them is, if you're using something that has privacy settings, it's not private. You just have to assume that they have privacy settings because the default is significant access by the public. And my experience is that people really lose sight of that. So, you know, what we need to do is to help people slow themselves down. And as you say, really think before they click on you know, post or upload or whatever it is, because the consequences definitely outlast the amount of time it takes to actually do the specific action we're talking about. I will tell you, and I think that this is a significant issue, is that we are seeing more and more of these problems in schools because of the fact that we now have a generation of teachers coming into the educational system. And again, this is going to be true for other workplaces as well, who have grown up with social media, who have grown up with smartphones, and their default mode of communication is electronic. And one of the things that I've witnessed and discussed in the school setting is that this has the effect of breaking down the traditional boundaries between educators and students. And so the upshot of that is that you have a flattening of relationships, and you have people interacting in ways that they never did before. And not surprisingly, it winds up creating significant problems.
Well, and the other thing that I totally agree with you, by the way, I have a niece who is teaches sixth grade in a school system in the New York area. And she struggles with this because, you know, I kiddingly tell her she grew up with an iPad in the crib and an iPhone Velcroed to her palm. And that does give them a different level of ability to communicate, but it also obviously, and you pointed out this many times in the book, comes at a very, very high cost if it's misused or if those boundaries are crossed over. And it's just this, yes, this unlimited access that people have both to the information and to each other in a way that we never did.
I couldn't put it better, honestly, Carol. And it's funny that you say, you know, with an iPad in a crib, because that is quite literally true. And that was one of the reasons that I felt literally compelled to write Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads. I joke about the fact that I have nieces who have a bigger social media profile than I do because, you know, my sisters, and yes, I'm calling them out, my sisters share huge amounts of material with them. And, you know, they're not, you know, or about them, they're not certainly the most aggressive in terms of device use, but I know a lot of people, you know, just looking around the street here in Brooklyn where I live, who let their kids use iPads at ridiculously young ages. And we can have a whole segment of this show about the implications that has for the development of empathy and socialization, because those are growing concerns among educators, pediatricians, all the rest of it.
Yeah. You can see all the ABC Mouse commercials that you want, but in truth of fact, that doesn't help with the socialization skills. There's so many worrisome things. I mean, we'll get into some of the medical concerns and the issues that you go into with radiation, but let's table that. Let's just hold that one for a little bit. Let's go back to this whole idea of information, because one of the other things that I picked up in the book that, again, I hadn't even thought about is whether it's the school boards, the school districts, or even in some cases, the state legislatures, because you had some unbelievable case studies. And what struck me is they are scrambling to catch up with this, and in some cases overreacting, and in a few cases maybe underreacting, but they're always playing catch up because this is such fast moving space with new technologies and new systems. But the point that really hit home for me was that they have to get sort of corral their teachers and their educators from whether it's profanity or explicit photos or, you know, whatever, because the problem is the kids have potential access, yes, to the exact same information. That is, again, that's something that's new in terms of the magnitude. You know, did little boys hide the Playboy magazine under the mattress? Sure. But nothing along those lines.
Exactly.
Nothing.
And actually, you'll get a kick out of this, because my original book proposal for Obscene Profits was entitled "What's That Computer Doing Under Your Mattress?" which I deeply regret never made it into print, because I think it's actually a really fun title. But it was with exactly that thought in mind, right? Is that, yes, kids have curiosity, which is absolutely natural. What's different is that we, and by we, I mean parents and adults, have now provided kids with devices which are unbelievably powerful in terms of their access to the world and in terms of shaping their attitudes through exposure to content. So one of the things that, you know, we constantly grapple with, and this is where I get into this issue of how much younger kids are using these devices. One of the things that we grapple with is that children and adults are now interacting in the same online spaces. And what that essentially does is it compresses the age variation that has traditionally governed society. You know, for much of my life, there were places where adults hung out and interacted in an adult fashion and consumed adult beverages and all of that good stuff. And there were places where kids hung out. And these were age and socially appropriate venues for the different demographics. Online, that vanishes. And so what you end up having is a situation where kids can either be victimized or are learning things that they may not be emotionally prepared to deal with.
Well, and clearly they aren't, because we hear it in the news every day. The most recent one that, you know, was on national news, and it was from one of the southern states, I honestly forget which one, where the teacher took off with a 13-year-old kid and they were on the road for, what, 35 days before they found him out in California?
For your listeners, on my website, Frederick Lane, I've got the Cyber Traps blog, and I write about some of these more compelling cases. And the Elizabeth Thomas Tad Cummins case from Tennessee was one that I wrote about in detail. Yeah, they were on the road for 39 days. He's 50, she's 15. And they were finally discovered by somebody who had seen the reports online. And one of the most recent accounts, because there have been a couple of court hearings on it, illustrates how destructive this can be. She is still absolutely convinced that they did nothing wrong, and that as a 15-year-old, she's completely entitled to determine the course of her own life. She professes to be still in love with the teacher, et cetera, et cetera. Now, not all of that communication took place online. There were also in-person, and there was also in-person and physical grooming that occurred over a period of months. But there's also no question that the electronic communication played a role in it.
Because wasn't there a lot of texting that went on back and forth? Yeah, between the two of them. And that was an interesting point that you made in the book. Again, speaking now specifically to educators and teachers, that using electronic communication obviously, you know, has to happen in today's world. But how you do it to both protect yourself and protect the student and the school district and the parents, you know, fill in the blank. You had some very specific recommendations.
Sure, I think
so. You want to just highlight a couple of those?
The two most important recommendations are for the school district to have very clear policies and procedures in place about how electronic communication should occur. And most importantly, when they should occur. You know, one of the examples that I use a fair amount, Carol, involves situations where a student who has either a phone number or an ID for a teacher on some messaging service reaches out to that teacher at a very late hour. Let's say, you know, 11:30, quarter of 12, the odds are exceedingly good that that communication is going directly from one bedroom to another. And implicitly, even if the text of the conversation is completely benign, the very fact that it's occurring at that hour and it's implicitly going from one private space to another weakens the boundary that should exist between an educator and a teacher. It invariably does. And in my research, one of the things that's so disturbing about that is that in a significance, you see the conversation almost immediately segue into personal interaction, much of which can be emotionally charged. And my friend Troy Hutchings, who works at ETS, Educational Testing Service, has really declared this to be the slippery slope for educators, particularly those who are passionate about their students, who love teaching, who really want to reach out and communicate with students where they communicate or how they communicate. And it makes them vulnerable to this kind of emotional slippery slope. And I can't tell you often enough how fast these conversations will go from what page is the homework on to you looked really depressed today, what's wrong, to my wife doesn't love me. And then all bets are off. Or I'm having a problem with my parents and I'm really depressed. Boom. And that's, you know, if you talk to psychologists, that is a big flashing neon light if someone is themselves emotionally vulnerable as an educator, or God forbid, they're predatory, in which case they have all the information they need.
Right, right. And that was the other thing that I was thinking about as I was reading the book, is the fact that didn't suddenly have an explosion of predators in this world. But this is the type of thing that could put people into those tipping point situations. And I was really interested with some of the case studies that you had that were just so well researched, that were examples of exactly what you said, where the teachers really were quite innocent, if you will. You know, they didn't go into it with the intention of doing harm to a child or harm to themselves, mm-hmm. or, you know, they did it maybe from a good place, but then it went too far. And then in many cases, the school boards or even the law in that area came down very hard on them, because again, that goes back to my comments earlier about their playing catch up, trying to figure out how to deal with
and
this.
Let me make one
and either overreact or underreact.
You had asked for a couple of examples. And the other thing, in addition to having good rules and procedures, is looking at the technology itself. And so what I tell school districts and educators is that there are plenty of tools out there to make it possible to have group conversations. And I urge educators and frankly, you know, anybody who works with kids, that if a child is communicating at a time that seems questionable, or frankly, for the safest course of action anytime, to make sure that the communication channel that is used has at least one other adult on it. It could be a supervisor. It could be a colleague. It could be a parent. And I know that, you know, this all needs to be adapted to the circumstances that the educator is facing, the nature of the conversation, et cetera. But if you value your career, and if you really are looking to help children as transparently as possible, then get another adult into the conversation. Look, we're adults. We clearly understand that teachers have an almost infinite number of tools to be predatory if they unfortunately choose to be that way. But requiring or establishing as best practice transparency in communications will help those folks who might slip down the slope otherwise.
Yeah, and the other thing that I see, certainly with the millennials and to a pretty significant degree, the Gen Y folks that are out there, the privacy filter is not in their vocabulary. They don't understand it. You made the point earlier about teachers that really do care and do want to get involved. And we'll talk about this, I'm sure, when we get to the parents too, about posting everything in God's green earth on the computer. And it's like, what are the consequences of this going to be down the road? But I don't want to lead us down a bunny trail. It was sad to me to see how many probably fine teachers' careers were just in shambles or disintegrated because of just some very, very bad judgment in terms of what you're saying. So I love the tip about having at least one other adult in the communication chain, because that can become a safety net. I can see that going a long ways. What about just not responding to someone who texts you at 11 o'clock?
Depending on the nature of what the text is. I mean, obviously, if you have a student who is expressing some kind of crisis, then you would want to make sure that you helped that student find the appropriate help. That actually leads me to a point that I think is important, which is that one of the reasons that educators get into the kinds of problems I write about is that they take on a role they're not trained for, which is as therapist or as counselor. And people who do that kind of work receive very specific training that is designed to give them bulwarks and defenses against interaction that is inappropriate with their clients or with their patients or what have you. Teachers don't have that training. But if they start to try to do that kind of work, they run a real risk there. So, you know, I absolutely want to encourage people as part of the in loco parentis responsibility to assist students in getting the right help. But that right help may not be them. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is what I tell people is it's really good to have a very consistent, canned response for the non-emergency queries, which is to say, thank you for contacting me. I do not respond to texts after 7 at night, please see me first thing in the morning, period. And that's it.
Yeah. I know this sounds ridiculous, but thinking back to the old days when you left the school, the only way they had to get a hold of you was to call on a telephone. And after a certain hour, your parents were always the one to answer anyway. So that, those barriers existed, not for that intentional purpose, but they were there and they were much clearer than they are today. And that's what, again, really strikes me about this whole conversation is that the lines have become so blurred that, I think we have a very confused society out there. We have confused children. We have confused educators. We have frustrated, obviously, school boards and legislators who are just grappling with this. But I guess my question, and I do want to move on to the expected moms before we, run out of time here, moms and dads. What should, how should the school boards and the legislators be responding to this? Because that seems to be, I don't know if it's an opportunity or if it's too late or besides the policies, because you've already talked about that.
Answer. But part of the answer, I think, lies in the fact that it's not about the technology, it's about the behavior. And if we approach it from that perspective, we can free ourselves of this sort of challenge, if you will, of trying to keep up with every new twist and turn in technology and instead focus on the way people treat each other and the behavioral expectations that we have. We can loosely lump this under a concept that I've been working on called digital citizenship, which is to say, create standards of behavior and incorporate that in every level of the curriculum and also provide tools to parents to help them teach these lessons at home and really make it clear that, much like drunk driving, where we now have a built-in default to having a designated driver, we have certain societal expectations. Part of it maybe is an updated golden rule, post unto others as you would have them post unto you. But even more broadly than that, there are just social norms,
right,
that we all should be teaching kids from the earliest days forward so that eventually, as we adapt to this relatively new technology, after all, we're only talking a decade for smartphones and we're really only talking 15 years for social media and maybe 25 years or 30 years tops for the, internet/World Wide Web. So this is all really, really new from a social perspective. And we're in that transitional period. We just need to commit ourselves to teaching the next generation how we can behave without tearing each other apart.
Which is a great segue into cyber traps for expecting moms and dads, because again, very similar themes, but a little bit different here, because now we're talking parental responsibility from the womb or actually you even started before that from conception right on through to birthing. But again, things that expecting parents and then future parents need to be thinking about. And this is where we can get into some of the medical stuff. I want to start with a different topic.
Yes.
And again, this really, really struck me that we're becoming a society of narcissists.
It really stems from the fact that for the last 20 years, college researchers have been delivering a self-assessment test to college freshmen, and thousands of freshmen have taken this test. And the purpose of the test is to evaluate how people fall on the narcissistic personality disorder spectrum. And one of the things that they have concluded is that over that 20-year period, the students taking the test have shown rising levels of narcissism. And we can get into all kinds of debates about how destructive that is and so forth. One of the things, though, that it corresponds with, which is more disturbing, is a similarly tested measurable decline in empathy, which is obviously, consideration of other people's feelings, the ability to appreciate what other people are going through, and so forth. And that actually does have significant implications for our society as a whole. So, one of the things that people are trying to evaluate, and there's a lot of logical speculation about this, is that the internet in general, but then also smartphones in particular, have contributed to this rise in narcissism because so much of our digital activity is about us, right? Is about how we look. It's how we're dressed. It's, you know, what are we saying? Do we get enough likes?
Right.
Particularly among millennials and the Gen Zers, which is the next generation, basically from 2000 forward, the curation of their life to put the best face forward is really time consuming. And it is contributing to a lot of body dysmorphia issues, you know, body image concerns about how they look, the shape of their bodies, the shape of their nose, and so on. And these are not entirely new. But the thing is that now we have this device which allows us to obsess about it in very public ways.
Yeah, it isn't just picking up a teen magazine or a Vogue magazine and obsessing over the thin models and that body image. Because you're right, that's always been there. But now, again, when your face is out there on a selfie or two or three or 4,000, there's no way to escape that. And I can see this contributing to everything from, depression and weight issues and bad eating disorders. And then, of course, on the flip side, you already mentioned earlier, cyberbullying.
Teen-oriented magazines, and they're writing about the fact that, you know, not just young women, but young men, too, will put up these photos. And if they don't get a certain number of likes almost instantaneously, they take it down because it's clearly not good enough. And this really shapes their interaction with their peers, their perception of themselves. And I think one of the challenges we face as parents and as members of a society is that the consequences of these kinds of behaviors can literally take years to unfold. We don't really know yet what the impact of all of this will be, but there are some early warning signs that are pretty disturbing, particularly with respect to depression and suicide.
Yeah, and that is scary. And then going back to your point about creating this narcissistic trend that they're seeing in the education testing, it's what the workforce is inheriting too, because I deal with a lot of clients who are struggling. I do a lot of work in the cross-generational workforce, and they don't know how to manage millennials. And it's like, you know, all they care about, and listen to this, this is exact quotes, all they care about is themselves. All they want is a promotion. All they want is more money. All they want is time off. They understand they work for me. And there's this huge disconnect between the way the kids see the world and trying to turn that into positive energy. And they want to be challenged. They want to have a voice, which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yes, it does.
But when you layer that label of narcissistic on top of it, then it becomes pretty ugly.
Is because I think the themes that I raise in these Cybertraps books are hugely relevant to employers of every description. Because within basically 18 months of now, Carol, 50% of the workforce will be millennials. That's the tipping point at 2020. And it's in terms of the people going into the workforce and the impact of technology, it is simply going to accelerate. And I think that we need to think deeply about these things. I think we need to be very innovative in terms of how we approach millennials. To be fair to them, they often have mad technical skills, you know, and there's a lot of things they bring to the table in terms of their creativity and their use of technology. But these more interpersonal issues, not surprisingly, are struggles for them.
Well, they are. And again, because I want to circle back to the cyber traps for expecting moms and dads, because the moms and dads of this youngest generation are contributing to this in ways that I don't even think. Well, I know they haven't thought about it. And like to your point earlier, we haven't seen the repercussions up. And I'll pick out one specific thing that hit me about baby announcements. Okay. So we're past the birthing and the, you know, putting online videos on YouTube of the actual birth. You know, that's a whole different show. But the baby announcements, where you put out the name, the gender, the date and time of birth, the parents and the sibling names, the weight, the length, the location, the grandparents, who delivered. Only thing missing is the social security number. I mean, you're setting this kid up for identity theft for the rest of their lives.
And sonograms that did have the social security number on them. I know. It just absolutely floored me. I was amazed that people would post that stuff online and not really think that through. Your point is exactly right, Carol, that at a minimum, you've got an issue with respect to identity theft, because as they get older, unless they're well trained from a digital citizen point of view as to how to protect their data with good passwords, it's not uncommon for people to use sibling names or where they were born or their parents' names as passwords. I mean, obviously, I strenuously urge people not to do that. I highly recommend Dashlane or some of the other password right. vault programs, because it makes all of this much easier. But identity theft is absolutely an issue. The thing that I was driving at in Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads, which is a more inchoate issue, but one I think is very important, is that if a parent spends 12 or 13 years curating the child's online presence and sort of establishing who they are online, and then at 13 or 14, they begin to go online themselves, I think there's been a real co-option of the child's identity.
Well, yeah, exactly. And are they going to appreciate all those photos? Because, again, that stuff's out there for life. They're going to have to live with that now. And the parent has shaped it. Yeah, I've thought about that before I read the book. And it was like, you know, your child's going to come around and sue you one of these days because they can't get into an Ivy League school.
And
they can't,
exactly,
you know, get a job
right.
that they want because of the stupid stuff that you put out there about them when they had no choice.
Yeah, that young woman, 18, her parents actually were refusing to take down her childhood photos.
Wow.
And she sued under the European privacy laws, basically saying, you have no right to put that material up there when I couldn't consent to it. And I, you know, as you know, in the book, in Expecting Moms and Dads, I've got some practical suggestions for people about how they can share those photos in ways that don't co-opt the child's identity. And I think that they're worth thinking about. I really do, because I think that we, particularly as online presence grows more and more important, and it will only grow more important, we as adults, as parents, should take some responsibility in leaving our children the space to establish their own identity.
I completely agree. So I'm watching our time here because there's two more things that I want to make sure we touch on before we run out of time. But before we do that, because I know people are listening to this and going, my God, how can I get these books and how can I get in touch, either get in touch with this man, maybe to come in and talk to my school district, or just buy his book. So let's give some contact information. Best website for them to go to, Frederick.
FRICKLANE.com.
Perfect. Okay. And again, the books that we're talking about, and you can buy them through your website, but you can also get them on Amazon, is Cyber Traps for Expecting Moms and Dads and Cyber Traps for Educators. And the third one is Cyber Traps for Youth. All relevant, all very, very consistent themes. So let's talk about real health risks. Because again, this information that you shared in these books, again, was something, you know, that's been talked about a little bit in the media, but maybe not enough. And again, we may not even have enough data to know the long-term consequences.
They generate heat. They generate noise. All of these things, at least theoretically, can interact with various parts of our bodily functions. I think it is important to say, as I do in the book, that there's considerable debate about the actual scope of any harm, if any. So I don't want people to just freak out. But what I do want people to do is to look at what the debate is. This is actually one of those scientific phenomena where there is a legitimate debate as to what is happening, as opposed to, say, climate change. And to just give some thought to whether or not they want to change how they use their devices. The things that I think are less disputable than others is that there do seem to be some good indications that fetuses, for instance, during pregnancy can be disturbed by the noise of a phone or a computer that's held close to the mother's belly. And that doesn't come as a surprise. It wakes us up in the middle of the night. It's logical it's going to wake up the fetus as well. There are concerns about the potential impact of heat if you're used to lying in bed and putting a hot laptop on your stomach when you are working, those kinds of things. And while the jury is absolutely out on the impact of radio frequency waves, I don't think it is unreasonable to be cautious with respect, particularly to newborn infants, and perhaps not not put them near devices that are emitting radio waves. I know a lot of scientists, because I read their studies, who, poo-poo any particular harm. There are others, though, who are a little bit more cautious about it. And I think parents should at least think about it.
Yeah. And as you're talking, to me, it follows the same logic of again, rules that mothers, mm-hmm. expectant mothers are given, that we all have come to expect. Don't smoke
again.
While you're
right,
pregnant.
Exactly.
Don't take drugs. Don't drink while you're pregnant. Don't take saunas, the warm baths. Right. There's the heat issue again. So we know those things logically. And I came out of the real estate industry. I mean, it's been known for a very long time that you probably don't want to buy a house with young children if you're near high tension lines, because the electromagnetic waves. So the logic of what we're talking about here, to me, follows that same train of thought.
Privacy and smart devices for little infants. There's a huge amount of pressure on parents to get smart onesies to monitor breathing and sleeping.
Oh, love it.
To get webcams. To actually, there's a new device out now that will monitor your baby's diaper and send you a text message when he or she needs to be changed. It's just mind blowing. I think parents should think long and hard, though, about the privacy implications of these devices. A lot of webcams have significant security flaws. I wrote about that on the Cybertraps blog. People can take a look at that. Privacy is wildly erratic in the United States in terms of protection of data. Again, probably not a direct, immediate threat to the health or safety of the infant. But I think as a parent, I would be reluctant to just willy-nilly turn over biological information about my baby without having some idea of how that data might be used.
Yeah. Well, and that's what it's all about, because at the end of the day, no matter what site it is, whether it's Google or Amazon or Facebook or Snapchat, they're all about making money, and their best tool for doing that is to share the data that they've amassed about us. That's we'll save that for another show, because that's a whole other interesting topic about what they do with data. Anyway, this has truly been amazing and very enlightening.
Thank you, Carol.
I know I'm going to get tons and tons of questions and inquiries about this. So I'm promising you now you're going to have to come back again so we can continue this conversation. But thank you, thank you, thank you. So again, fredericklane.com. You're looking for the books on if you even go to Amazon and type in Cybertraps, you will pull his books up immediately. But these are really good, easy reads with a lot of documented and well-researched information with some sound sage advice. So regardless of how old or young you are, it's absolutely worth the time and effort.
It's
and
been
Frederick,
a real pleasure,
I can't thank
Carol.
You
thank
enough.
You, again
you certainly
for having
enlightened me, and I know you have enlightened my audience, and I appreciate you being a guest on the LinkedIn Lady Show. So friends, we are at the end of the show today. Just wanted to remind you, we'll be back tomorrow with Social Solutions with my cohort in crime, Mr. Ken Herron. I know we'll be talking about the big cyber hacks as well as a whole lot of other things. So stay with us. Make sure you download the podcast. Make sure you listen live and pass it on to your friends, because we're always here to give you the top of the minute, most important information for yourself, for your family, and of course, for your business. So thanks for listening. And as always, I leave you wishing you quality connections and natural networking. Have a great day.